You're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and you are here with Radio Naturopath. And today, we have a very special guest. It's very exciting. So for the next 2 hours, first with Radio Naturopath and then with Bicycle Talk, we have Amber Pierce. Yep, we've got her. We are so excited.
A true celebrity.
Yeah, yes.
Local celebrity.
Local celebrity.
Yeah.
Indeed. So Amber began her sporting career as a swimmer, and she broke state and national records while still at high school. And she began cycling when she joined the Stanford cycling team. And she has a bachelor's in human biology and a master's in earth systems from Stanford University. You went to Stanford?
Yes, I did.
And everything.
How about
all right.
that? Wow.
And in January 2015, she was a member of the Pepper Palace racing team. And now you are currently a member of the...
VitaLogic racing team, UCI women's team.
Very good. So we're very excited to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So we would like, during Radio Naturopath, we would like to talk to you about what you know about health and fitness and as it relates to cycling. And I'm sure you've got a lot of opinions and you've got a lot of experience, whether personally or through things you've observed and also things that you've studied.
Absolutely.
Yes. So, but first of all, let's get to know you a little bit first. So can you I've given you a short bio. So just tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get started in cycling and what makes it so exciting for you?
Well, the way I got started in cycling is actually, well, to sum it up really succinctly is, I was just that bad of a runner. So as you said, I was a swimmer. So I was a swimmer growing up. I started swimming pretty seriously at about the age of 10. I really just loved it. And it was the first time that I realized I could be on a swim team and swim competitively. And I just got really excited about it and enthusiastic enough that it carried me through all the way through. Well, not all the way through college, halfway through college. And I ended up having to get shoulder surgery, as many swimmers do. And I couldn't swim the way I used to, and I was pretty burned out by that point, to be honest. I was ready to be done with competition, but I really enjoyed feeling fit, and I missed that feeling of just feeling really fit. So I tried a different method of getting fit, which was running, and I was really, really terrible at it. So I was in grad school at the time, and well, I was kind of doing a co-terminal master's degree, so I was working in a lab, and I would come into the lab every day complaining about shin splints. And my advisor finally got so fed up with me complaining about shin splints that he said, "I have a bicycle in my garage. For the love of God, will you please just take it?" So that was how I started riding. And I found that actually riding didn't cause shin splints. And I was working actually at a satellite campus in Monterey at the time. So it was a beautiful place to ride a bike, so naturally I fell in love with riding, and that was sort of how I transitioned into cycling.
That's great. So you started cycling. So you were cycling back in California.
Mm-hmm.
Uh huh. And so when you were on it. When did you first start getting racing professionally? How did you make that transition?
Well, like I said, I was really burned out on competition by the time I started riding a bike. And I was genuinely only interested in riding for fun and fitness. And that's what I did for a long time. But I also had some fellow grad students who did mountain bike racing on the collegiate circuit. And they said, "Oh, you should come out and do some mountain bike races." And I said, "Oh, no, you don't understand. I don't race. I don't compete. This is just for fun." And they said, "Well, it's not really racing so much as we just do a road trip on the weekend and go camping and party, and at some point you ride your bike."
Nice.
So that sounded pretty good to me, and so really I got started in the racing aspect of it, mostly for the parties and not for the racing. And for a long time I really refused to take it seriously, and this was sort of my own internal defense mechanism against getting too caught up in the competition. And that was, I never trained. I never did any structured training. I just rode for fun. And that way, when I showed up at the races, I couldn't have any big expectations. So there would be no disappointment. And I really was just there for the camaraderie, which was fantastic. And I had a great time that first season. I didn't set the world on fire or anything like that. And as the mountain bike season came to a close, the road season started getting going. And my fellow cyclist said, "Hey, you should come out and do the road season. It's just as much fun as mountain biking." And I said, "Yeah, that sounds pretty good."
Sorry.
Yeah. For those of you listening, mountain biking culture and road cycling culture are very, very different animals.
Night and day. Yes.
Right. But I had a really great time road cycling because it was a lot of the same people that were involved as were involved with the mountain biking team. So again, it was a really nice continuity with that camaraderie. And that first season, I'd love to tell you that I just was this breakout phenom, but I wasn't at all. Like I said, I wasn't training seriously or doing structured training. So I came out and I had decent results, and we had our team actually went to collegiate nationals that year, and we needed four women to go, and we pretty much only had four women on the team that could go. So I was one of the four, and again, it was not some breakout phenom performance. I got dropped in the crit probably about two laps in. I remember coming around a corner and seeing the team coach on the side of the road making a slit motion across his neck.
Oh, dear.
Indicating that I might as well pull the plug at that point. And I ended up crashing in the road race. So I think I finished, but of course I crashed out of contention. But while I was there, I got to watch one of the most beautiful and dramatic bike races I've ever seen. And it was beautiful and dramatic to me because it was one of the first times I'd seen something like this. And that was the men's criterium at that race. And it was beautiful and dramatic because it was this really technical circuit. It was happening in the evening. We were in the Midwest. We were in Madison, Wisconsin. And there was this enormous thunderstorm that was coming through. And they actually had to delay the men's race because this thunderstorm was so intense. And so by the time the men started, it was dark outside. So the only light that they had lighting the course was the street lamps. It was still raining. There were still, you know, claps of thunder and these bright flashes of lightning. And these guys were just ripping through the turns. It was the most amazing thing that I've ever seen. And I remember standing on the side of the road thinking, I want to be able to do that.
Yeah.
I really want to get good at this. So it just flipped a switch in me, and it went from being really resistant to getting back into competition to being all in. And I was really fortunate because I had a lot of friends on the team who were much more experienced than I was, and they were willing to take me under their wing. So I got a lot of advice in terms of how to structure training and how to structure nutrition and how to actually start progressing as a competitive athlete in this sport. So the following season, you know, from that point on, pretty much I started taking it pretty seriously. And so the following season, I trained coming into the collegiate season, and I ended up winning a bunch of races. I ended up winning our collegiate conference championships, and then I ended up winning the national championships. And that was sort of the beginning of my real road racing career. And then by the end of that season, I had signed a pro contract.
That's so exciting. So I want to actually transition there, because I want to get more into your racing career and all about that on a little bit later. But I would like to transition more into to health and fitness. So you're a competitive athlete, and you know, people listening to Radio Naturopath, most of us are not competitive athletes. Some of us, you know, try our hands at it. A lot, most of us listening, you know, we walk, but then something gets in the way and we don't get our walk in. That's what we're dealing with. So one of the things that we can do, I feel like, is people who are avid fitness enthusiast, and yourself as a professional athlete, we can be very inspiring. And one of the things we can also be is intimidating, and we want to try not to be that. But one of the things I found about you, Amber, is that you are indeed very inspiring.
Thank you.
You are not a person who you get around who, like when I'm around you, I don't feel like I'm in competition with you.
I hope so.
One of your gifts is that first of all, you're a woman, and then you're an athlete, and so you can inspire we women to at least get out there and do something that's good for ourselves. So a lot of people can't get into a regular schedule of exercise, or they just haven't managed to do it. And so how can somebody like you or us inspire somebody to get started?
Well, there's a lot of things that you can do, but I think one good starting point is to adjust how you frame the problem. And, you know, not necessarily a problem, but the challenge of establishing a routine or integrating more exercise and fitness into your life than you already do. And one challenge that I've observed for women in particular, and this is a gross generalization, so I'm not saying this is a challenge for all women or only women, but it's very common for women just because of certain social norms that we have, is that women are generally, again, gross generalization, expected to be very nurturing and very selfless. And so it can be really difficult for us as women to justify taking time for ourselves to go for a ride, to go for a swim, to take time at the gym, because there's the sense of when we're doing something like that for ourselves, we're taking time away from our family, our job, our other responsibilities to other people in our lives, and it feels very selfish. And, you know, I don't like casting in selfishness or selflessness, and let me explain why. I think we can all agree that being selfless is a wonderful thing. And when we think of selflessness, we think of giving. We think of giving time and money and attention. And we all want to do that. We want to be that selfless giving person. But what we forget is that it's super important to invest in your capacity to give. Because if you're just out there giving, giving, giving all the time, and you don't ever invest in your capacity to give, eventually your health is going to break down. And if you are depressed and ill, what do you have left to give to the people in your life? And one way I think it's important, especially for women, but for anybody really, to frame this is that when you take time to exercise, to invest in your health, to invest in your wellness and your sense of well-being and happiness, it's going to invest in your capacity to give to everyone else in your life. So you can show up for the people in your life as the best version of yourself, brimming over with energy and joy. And that is going to have a far more positive ripple effect on the people in your lives than just constantly giving, giving, giving and being a martyr. It's a really important aspect of life in general and being that selfless giving person. So I think that that's a really important starting point, is to understand that establishing a routine, taking time for yourself to do these things, it's not selfish. It's actually the absolute necessary foundation for being selfless and nurturing and showing up for people in your life.
Right.
Wow. That's great.
I love
it.
That's very, very well said.
That was beautiful.
Yeah.
Take care of yourself so you can take care of others.
Yeah.
Is essentially what the message is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to make sure that you take care of yourself so you can actually put out that energy. I love
exactly.
it. That's great.
Yeah.
That was tremendous.
It's like that idea of when you're on the airplane, before you can help other people, you have to put your own oxygen mask on first.
Exactly.
And we believe...
I'm not doing that. I'm not going on a plane that I'll have to do that.
We hope not.
No, that's right.
So put on your oxygen mask first. Remember yourself first, because that. And I like to tell people that if you love to help other people, if you love to take other care of other people, it is very important, as you said, to take care of yourself first, that you need to fill your own well so that there's something in the well.
Exactly.
So that you can have something to take out. Okay. So that's a wonderful thing. All right. So now we can focus on cycling. Now, a lot of people, I hear this all the time, people are afraid of bicycles. And what I'm interested in for people, I would love it if everyone would ride a bicycle. I can't expect everyone to ride a bicycle. But what I tell people in terms of my practice is the best exercise for you is the one you'll do, whatever that is.
Exactly.
However, you're a cyclist. So I would love to talk with people or to have your perspective on how can people get started in cycling? Say you're somebody, because this is who a lot of who we're speaking to, people who are older or people who are in a place in their lives where they haven't begun fitness or haven't made fitness something that's regular in their lives. How can somebody later in life get started in cycling just altogether?
Yeah, well, I think a more general important point to make is that, like you said, the best exercise is the one that you'll do. And chances are that the one that you'll do is the one that's actually kind of fun. So finding a way to make something fun. I mean, if you enjoy bird watching, you know, going out for hikes and bird watching, trying to incorporate it and think of it more as a hobby rather than as, you know, an exercise regime. And that's one thing that I really love about cycling. For me, cycling is really fun. And it's the kind of thing where you're moving quickly enough that you can cover a lot of ground and really go exploring. And that's my favorite thing to do, is to go on a big ride, explore new roads. Because every time I go for a bike ride on familiar roads, there's always these little side roads. And I always think, where does that road go? And I love going on rides where you go and solve the where does that road go mystery. But that's one of the wonderful things about bikes. I mean, I remember just as a little kid, you know, it was the coolest feeling in the world to go, you know, around the block and then go one block further. I mean, it felt like you were in this whole new world, and it's the sense of freedom and empowerment about it. So cycling is a really fun thing, but like you said, there's a lot of intimidating aspects about it. So the safety issue is a big one for people. Being intimidated about riding, you know, on roads with other cars. Obviously, you don't have to do that. You can always pick up a mountain bike or a cross bike and ride on the dirt trails. We have an amazing trail system around here, lots of which Our legal use for bicycles as well. So that's always an option if you're, if you just absolutely don't want to ride on the road. But riding on the road is actually, I mean, there are risks to everything we do. And my parents always get nervous about me riding bikes, you know, whether it's for training or for racing. And I always, the analogy that I use is, before you learn to drive a car, the idea of driving a car on the road in traffic is terrifying. Let alone getting on a freeway, for example, and driving a car. It's a terrifying prospect. But then you learn to drive a car, and all of a sudden, you're doing it all the time. Now, there's always a risk. You can't control what anybody else is going to do. But are you in a state of panic every time you get on the freeway to drive your car? No, because you've learned a skill set and you feel confident in your ability to manage the risk, to drive safely, to drive defensively, and even to manage circumstances that may arise because somebody else is making a mistake. And that's how I feel when I'm on the bike. And I think that that's a really important perspective to keep in mind, is that there's a learning curve, but it's not the case where you're just going to be in the state of panic every time you get on your bike because it's so scary and intimidating. It's not. So I think one of the best ways to get over that is to go out with somebody who's experienced on a bike. And I have a great story about this. So I race bikes for a living and I love it. And obviously I'm really passionate about it, but it's not something that my parents do. And like I said, they get really nervous for me riding bikes. And I, for a long time, I would be out on training rides and I'd just be thinking, gosh, you know, this is so beautiful and this is such an amazing ride and the scenery is amazing. And I just wish my parents could be here and see this, because if they could be here and experience this, then they'd get it. And so my husband and I actually lived overseas in Austria for a while. So my parents came over to visit us at one point and I thought, okay, I've just got to get them out. It's just so beautiful here and I got to get them out and show them what this is like. And my mom agreed. And the plan was that we were going to take e-bikes, so electric bicycles, because I mean, of course, everybody learns to ride a bike as a kid, but I mean, she hadn't been on a bike in decades. So there was this really big factor of intimidation there. And to her credit, she didn't let on about how nervous she was. But I said, okay, we're going to go on this training route that I always do. It's really beautiful. And we're gonna ride e-bikes, because I, of course, there's a lot of climbing in Austria and I didn't want her to just feel like she was being tortured the entire time. And the e-bike was this really great compromise where you have a throttle, an electric motor, but you have to pedal in order for the motor to work. So you actually have to, you got to work to move the bike. But you could use the throttle, and what she and I was thinking she would want the throttle to kind of assist her up the hills, but it actually came in more handy whenever she felt like she was getting a little bit unstable. She could engage the throttle and get a little bit of momentum to steady her. But she rode 30 kilometers with me with over 1,000 meters of climbing.
Wow, look at that.
It was awesome. And so, like I said, she didn't let on about how nervous she was. She was such a trooper. She came out and she did this whole ride. And as we were coming back into town, she was literally giggling. She was having such a great time. She sounded like a kid in a candy store. It was the coolest thing. And afterwards, she told me, she said, you know, I literally did not think that I could actually physically do this. She said, I was so worried that I was going to let you down, that I wasn't going to be able to do this. But I just, you know, she's like, you talked me into it and here we are. And she was so, it wasn't just about getting outside and getting to see this beautiful scenery, which was amazing, but it was the sense of accomplishment that came with it, and with the essential sense of accomplishment, the sense of empowerment. And she blew herself away that she was able to do this thing. And to me, that was a perfect example of you know, you think you can't, but if you go with somebody who's going to give you some reassurance and kind of walk you through those first steps and that initial part of the learning curve, you'll find that you can do so much more than you think you can. And it's so much less scary than you imagine. In fact, it's not scary at all. It's just pure fun and pure joy. So if anybody out there is listening and you're interested in riding, we have an incredible community here. A lot of people who really enjoy riding bikes. Ask around. Store Center Cycles just up the road. They know a lot of people who ride mountain, ride road. You don't need a big fancy bike. Any bike that's in safe working condition will do. If you're not sure about it, take it down to the local shop, have someone look it over, make sure that it's in safe condition. I highly recommend using a helmet. I personally don't ride anywhere without a helmet.
It's like driving your car with a seatbelt on.
Right.
Good
exactly.
idea.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Good idea. So there are a few basic equipment requirements to getting into cycling, but it doesn't have to be like a really expensive bike. It can be any bike in safe working condition and a helmet, and you're ready to go.
I think that's a great idea, starting out, going with somebody who's confident. And the other thing, that people say is when they get started out and they're riding with someone else, they're afraid that that person's going to outride them.
Right.
And what we try to explain to people, like when we're riding with less experienced cyclists, that we're not going to do that.
Right, right.
You know, and so that's something that's important to do. Find people that you're going to ride with who are willing to, like what you did with your mother and what I do with my father. You just ride at their pace.
Right.
That there's no reason to compete with somebody, because then you're going to create advocacy, and you're going to create a situation where someone's going to get excited about it. So that's a wonderful idea, that if you're somebody who hasn't ridden a bike in a long time and you're not sure if you have the fitness for it, find an e-bike.
Yeah.
You know, an electronic bike that will help move you up the hill. And Ron, why don't you explain what an e-bike is?
So an e-bike is an electronic assist bicycle. Most of them are electronic assist now. They used to be where you would just, you'd have that separate throttle, and that's what it was. But most of them are now set up with a torque sensor within the actual pedals of the bike, so that they can actually sense when you need assistance, which is cool, because they'll sense it by the amount of pressure you're putting down on the pedals. So if you're getting to a hill and you're having to put a lot more pressure down on the pedal, that's when the motor will kick in. So they are much more sophisticated than they were years ago. When they first came out, I looked at them and I was your classic snobby cyclist and looked at them and said, really, you got to be kidding me. You know, this doesn't make any sense to me at all. But I've opened my mind and my brain didn't fall out, and I have learned that these are a great way to introduce people to cycling, because it's a really cool thing. And your experience with your mom is a classic example. I have a customer that I service that has a bicycle shop, and they have a someone who rides like we do. He rides a lot. And rides. And his wife is at home. She's tapping her toes. When's he going to get back from his ride? You know, the classic. And he got her an e-bike. And he took her out for a 25-mile loop that he does. And she got hooked, like, right away.
Awesome.
Now he said it repaired their relationship, that she's not anxious anymore, that he goes out and rides his bike. She's really thrilled about it. He takes her out for all these neat little rides that he's done over the years. He's excited. She's excited. Yay, here we go, e-bike. So e-bikes are a great idea. That's essentially it.
Well, and they get people into cycling. I have another question. For an e-bike, do you have to know how to balance on a bicycle riding an e-bike?
Pretty much, yeah. It's a two-wheeled vehicle, and it's the same concept as riding a bicycle. The only thing that it has, like your mom experience, is that, you know, it gives you that little burst ahead, which gives you the ability to get your balance right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you're moving forward, your balance comes naturally. When you're sitting still, your balance is not so good.
Right.
Are there options for people who can't balance on a bicycle?
Well, there are options. There are three-wheeled bicycles, so there's that option. You can get something called a trike, or you can get a recumbent bicycle, which is also either two or three wheels, but three wheels would be more stable. They make adult training wheels. They really do. So you can actually get a full-sized, like a 20-inch wheel, training wheel that would go on both sides of the back of the bike if you're really concerned about it, and that would get you started. I'm not a big fan of them because they make the bike very tippy.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though you would think it would make it very stable, when you go around a corner, it makes the bike want to tip over. So there are ways to get started, but the best way is to find a friend who's enthusiastic about helping you learn.
Right.
And let them walk. And, you know, I remember getting my sister back on a bike. She hadn't been on a bike for years. She was a little freaked out about it. And I just took her over into the yard, and I ran alongside of her and held onto the bike and got her pedaling, and she was off and running, and that was it.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, you can do it.
So, of course, a lot of people listening are interested in increasing their fitness, their nutrition, and even in losing weight. What kind of fitness can you expect to gain when you start riding a bicycle?
So riding a bicycle is a primarily aerobic effort, and there's different different forms of exercise you can do out there. And when I say aerobic is it's kind of a longer time endurance type of physical activity. And that's in comparison to something that's a little bit more explosive, short-term, high-intensity type activity. So the nice thing about riding is you can... ride around and go on long exploring bike rides, and it doesn't have to be a super high intensity. So the type of fitness that you're going to get from riding is primarily aerobic. And this, because this is a lower intensity type of activity, it's a kind of a no pain but lots of gain strategy. You don't have to go out there and kill yourself to get a lot of to benefit from this type of fitness. And so in that sense, it's actually a really great way to get started, because you can just go out and you would be amazed by how much you gain just by going out and doing one or two rides a week, or starting to commute to work on a bicycle. It adds up really, really quickly, and you'll find one of the things I like to say is a body in motion tends to stay in motion. So, you know, the more you get out and get active, the more you'll want to get out and get active and feel good about getting out and getting active and have that higher motivation. So a lot of people are kind of like, well, I know I should exercise, I know I should get out and be a little more active, but it's hard to get started. But it's kind of like pushing a flywheel. You know, at first it's really, really hard. But as you start gaining momentum, all of a sudden, it's all you want to do. And so I think, that's a roundabout way of answering your question.
So you can mostly get an aerobic workout. Can you get an anaerobic workout? Can you get a variety of different workouts? Because one of the things you hear about is, you know, people get into CrossFit and people get into high intensity interval training.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do that on a bicycle?
Absolutely. So as a bicycle racer, and not everyone's going to race, I understand, but I'm just going to use this as an analogy. In a bike race, we go all kinds of speeds. So it's not like a track and field race where the gun goes off and everybody starts going as hard as they can from the gun. Bike racing is very strategic. We'll get into that later. But that means that the speeds change immensely during a bike race. So sometimes we'll be soft pedaling to the point where I'm barely even applying any pressure to the pedal. In fact, we might even be coasting. And then there are times when we'll be going up a really short, steep hill, and then you have to put out that really high intensity effort. So it's very possible to get everything from aerobic fitness to anaerobic fitness. So you can do high intensity intervals on a bike, especially this is something that is very common in spin classes. You do a really high intensity 10-second effort. But the thing to keep in mind, if you're interested in using cycling as an avenue towards fitness and training, is to be mindful of your recovery intervals. So this is something that is really important for health in general, but training is always about a balance of stress and recovery. So you want to stress your body a little bit. You want to push your body a little bit, not, you know, to the point of breaking, obviously, but getting out and challenging yourself and then allowing your body to recover from that challenge and come back stronger is how we build fitness. And so the higher the level of intensity of your efforts, the more recovery you need. So, and that also means that you want to maybe back down the amount of riding that you're doing. So if you're going to go out and do a really high intensity series of high intensity intervals, you might want to make that ride a little bit shorter than a ride where you're just going at a nice leisurely aerobic pace.
So if you do shorter rides and you do pack in some higher intensity intervals, you don't have to be out there as long. You don't have to exercise for as long.
Right, exactly. And that's actually something that's really cool about cycling is you can just get out on your bike, go out for a 30-minute ride. And depending on where you are and how the terrain is, you can build in a really effective workout into a pretty short amount of time, or even on your commute.
That's true.
Right,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and some people do that. All right. So, people want to know, can they expect to lose weight riding a bicycle?
It is definitely one of the things that can happen as a positive side effect of getting on a bike. I know a lot of people for whom this is true. But I think the important thing is, again, going back to this element of fun, whether or not you actually lose numbers on the scale, you are going to become healthier. This is a really, really positive, healthy activity for your body. So it's really easy on your joints. It's not only good for your body physically in terms of conditioning your muscles, but we were talking about balance earlier. The act of balancing is actually a really good exercise for your brain. And your brain is really working overtime, because if you imagine, I mean, you are literally balancing on two little skinny tires if you're on a road bike, slightly wider tires if you're on a mountain bike. But there's a lot of information about balancing and moving through the environment that your brain has to take in. So it's actually really good mentally, too. I mean, just for the fitness of your brain as well as your body. So there are so many physical, mental, emotional benefits to riding that, you know, you probably will lose weight, But remember that even if you don't lose those numbers on the scale, what you're gaining is probably several years on your lifespan, and not just, you know, any years, high quality years.
And one of the things I try to encourage people to do is don't focus so much on those numbers on the scale, that when you become consistent at eating healthfully and getting regular exercise, that's the thing you should be focusing on. And that's the thing you can document. And that's the thing you can know, today I went out for that bike ride, and you can write it down and you can celebrate it. And don't worry so much about, oh, I have 10 pounds to lose, because weight loss is neither linear, fair, nor predictable.
Right. And I think the most important thing is that you'll feel better. You'll just feel better. And as you feel better physically, mentally, emotionally, you're just going to be happier. And again, going back to what we talked about earlier, you'll become this, you know, optimal version of yourself. And it's just, you know, not only will you be happier, but you'll bring a lot more to the table for everyone around you in your life. And as far as, you know, body weight goes, I want to just, one of the things that I've come to the conclusion of in my experience as an athlete is everybody's built differently, obviously. But our bodies are smarter than we are. And so when I go out and I ride my bike for a training ride, for whatever it is, I think of it as I'm making a request of my body. I'm telling my body, I really enjoy this thing. This is the thing that I want to do. This is what I would like to do. And you're sending your body this information, this little request, like, this is what I would like to be able to do. So let's say I go out and I do some hill repeats. I'm going up and down the hill, and I'm, by doing that, I'm telling my body, I would like to be able to go up this hill fast. This is how fast I would like to be able to go up this hill. My body's smarter than I am. So my body's going to take that request and go, okay, she wants to be able to go up this hill fast. My body is going to optimize my physiology to allow me to do that. And of course, it will take time. So you have to make these requests over time and give your body time to respond to your request. But if you request politely, which is to say that you are challenging yourself in a positive way, not a negative way, that you're allowing yourself the recovery to allow your body to respond to this request. And if you're giving your body adequate or even optimal nutrition, your body is actually going to optimize your physiology to do what it is that you want to do. And it may not give you the body shape that you see in the magazine, but it's going to give you the optimal shape for your body to allow you to do the things that you want to do. And that's ultimately what we're after. So you might not be getting, you know, the perfect body that you have set in your mind as being, you know, that magazine image or whatever it happens to be. But you can rest assured that your body is going to, it's going to get you to where you want to go. And again, your body knows better than you do. So even if you had that body that you think is the perfect body, that might compromise your ability to do certain things in your life that you love. So let your body work with your body. You know, it's there. Be able to celebrate in what your body can do and work with it. And, you know, don't talk smack about it. Don't think smack about it, because your body's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. And one thing I try to encourage people to do is have patience.
Right.
That if you want to, like, if you have a goal, you want to hang on that particular group ride at that speed, or you want to be able to climb that hill at all, you may not be able to do it right away, but don't give up and have patience that if not this season, maybe next season, that anything that's worth accomplishing is going to take a bunch of small steps to get there. That if you can have patience, and figure out the steps and find the building blocks to accomplish what you're looking at accomplishing, that's just as important as accomplishing that thing. And then you find that what's just as exciting as accomplishing a goal is the journey to get there.
Yeah, sure.
And then you start enjoying every piece of it.
Exactly.
So let's get back to one of the things you and I have talked about is proprioception. Is one of the wonderful things about cycling is learning to know where you are in space. So can you describe, you're riding along on a bicycle, what's going on for you with your proprioception? And then ultimately, how does that help you in your life?
Right. So proprioception is, imagine closing your eyes for a moment and waving your arms around in the air. At any given moment, even if you can't see your hands or the tips of your fingers, you actually know where they are in space relative to you and to the things around you. So this is our proprioception, and it's a pretty amazing aspect that our bodies and our brains can do. And what happens is your brain actually has a map of your body in space, and that's how we are able to utilize this proprioception. And one of the cooler studies that I've read about was actually if you pick up a tool, whether it's a hammer or a pen, your body actually maps that tool as a part of your body. So if you close your eyes and you have a pen in your hand and you put that pen to paper, as you put the pen to paper, your brain actually knows where the tip of the pen is as if it were a part of your body. And the same thing happens when we get on a bicycle. So the more time you spend on a bicycle, the more your body and your brain are going to incorporate the bicycle actually as part of this body map in your brain. And so we have this. You might not realize it, but when you're riding a bike and you've been riding a bike a long time, you don't actually have to stare at your front tire to know where it is in space. You actually just have this innate sense of how far ahead of your bike is. So if you're riding behind somebody or in a group, you're not having to stare at the space between your front wheel and their rear wheel. You can actually look ahead up the road and see, you know, what obstacles are coming, because your proprioception is actually helping you figure out the spacing and where you are relative to everything else in space. And so this is, again, kind of going back to that idea of balance being good exercise for your brain. All of this is really good, you know, just mentally for exercising your brain circuitry. It's amazing how much of your brain is involved in the simple act of riding a bicycle. I mean, there's some really great YouTube videos out there of people just pushing a bike, you know, down a hill without a rider on it, and the bike, you know, it self-corrects. So even if it hits a bump or a little curve, it'll self-correct and ride itself. And there's still not quite a perfect understanding of the physics of how that works. And yet we can get on a bicycle and ride and go down hills and around corners, and our brains are doing this really complex algorithm in our heads the entire time of, you know, momentum and balance and all these things. We don't even have to think about it. And we just get to go along for the ride. It's great. And our brain's doing all the work in the background. We don't even know it.
Yeah. And all of that happens. And you start up by learning. It's like I'm experienced in dance to an extent. And I transferred dance skills onto the bicycle. They're not that different, because when you learn a dance routine or you learn to do a dance, you start in your brain. You start in your head thinking about, okay, I'm going to do this step. Then I'm going to do this. This is where I put my this is where I put this hand. This is where I put this foot. And then after a while, you get a sort of muscle memory that it almost feels like it's a different part of your brain. And then you get to know the dance, so you don't have to think about it anymore.
Exactly.
And then you can experience the flow and the emotion of being in that dance, because you have a muscle memory of it. So that happens on a bicycle too.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't. And there comes a point, I promise you, where you don't have to think about that. Think about, am I balanced? Am I next to somebody? And people get very nervous when they first start riding a bicycle.
Yeah, you're taking in so many, there's just so much sensory input. And when you first start, you're having to process each one of those inputs separately. So it's very additive. And the analogy I like to use is it's like learning to read. So when you first learn to read, you have to learn the shapes of the letters, and you learn each individual letter. And then you learn to sound out a word one letter at a time. And eventually your brain learns to recognize the patterns of those series of letters as just a whole word. And then after that, you start learning to take in sentences. And they've done tracking studies where they'll actually track where your eyes go when you're reading a page of text. And trust me, you're not actually looking at each letter and sounding it out. You're actually looking at these big chunks of patterns. So you start out by breaking down every single detail and having to process every single detail, but eventually your brain starts to recognize patterns, and you're able to process a huge amount of information with very little brain power, which is why it's so easy to read after so many years of reading. But when you first start, it's really hard, and you have to use a lot of brain power because you're breaking everything down into such teeny tiny detail. And it's the same thing on a bike. So at first you're thinking, okay, I'm coming to an intersection. I need to, you know, use which brake when. I need to signal. I need to look around for traffic. I need to make sure that when I'm scanning over my shoulder, I'm holding my line. And you're thinking about all these little details, and you're using a lot of brain power, but even after a few rides, or even by the end of one ride, you'll find that your brain has already started streamlining this process of processing the information, and all of a sudden it's really easy. And so after a while, you don't have to think about any of that stuff. It just becomes, you know, part of your automatic awareness, and you can just enjoy a conversation.
So one of the things about riding a bicycle is that I get patients who come in a lot, and they have issues with cognition, and they have issues with memory, especially as they age. And they have issues with balance. So a bicycle helps you with all of these things. It helps your proprioception, but also because you're learning something and you're learning a skill and you're learning to put all these elements together, you're creating new neural nets.
Exactly.
And you're building brain connections. So your brain continues to develop.
Mm-hmm. Albert Einstein rode a bicycle. You understand this?
Yeah.
You get this? Brilliant, brilliant man. He rode a bicycle. Yeah. I say no more.
Yes. He has a quote. If you could find it, that would be great.
Albert Einstein?
Oh, yeah. Yes, a bicycle quote.
I'll look it up.
Yeah. I think it's something along the lines of, I've thought of that while I was riding my bicycle when asked about the theory of relativity.
So bicycles create brilliant ideas. You think of brilliant things when you're on a bike.
It is a very meditative thing to do as well. Mm-hmm. So it is actually a really nice time to allow your brain to wander a little bit, especially if you're on a solo ride. And again, not wander so much that you're not aware of what's going on around you. But like we just said, it's really easy for that awareness to become automatic and instinctive. And then it's a really wonderful time for creating ideas, and it's just you get the creative juices flowing. And there have been plenty of times in my life where I've just suddenly been struck with a solution to something that's been bothering me for a really long time, and it usually happens on the bicycle.
Excellent. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay, here you go. There's three versions of this. Okay. Life is like riding a bicycle. Oh, are we there? Life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. People are like bicycles. They can keep their balance as long as they keep moving. Or it is the same with people as it is with riding a bike. Only when moving can one comfortably maintain one's balance. So it's all about the whole balance and movement thing. And yeah.
And Einstein's, this is reportedly attributed to Einstein.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Reportedly, you know, there's different versions here they're talking about, because no one really has the actual one. But the one I've always remembered the most is life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving.
Right. And then there's get on your bikes and ride.
That's Freddie Mercury.
All right. So obviously, Amber, you know, training to be a professional cyclist, you have to do hard training intervals. You have have to do some hard work, and you have to do some hard efforts. And some days you do, I'm sure you do long, hard efforts, and some days you do short intervals. Are there any days when you go out and you go really easy?
Oh, yeah. At least twice a week. So I usually take one day off the bike completely per week. And then in addition to that, I usually have one day where I do what's called a recovery ride. And a recovery ride, so taking a day off is obviously recovery as well, but doing a recovery ride is what we call active recovery. So you're still moving, you're still getting outside. And the nice thing about doing a recovery ride is you're not taxing any of your systems. You're not taxing your anaerobic system, you're not taxing your aerobic system. You're going really, really, really easy. And the reason active recovery is so beneficial is you get your blood pumping a little bit. Your heart rate should stay very low, but it's still going to be elevated relative to, you know, sitting on the couch. So your blood is moving, but you're not taxing any system. So you're just flushing out the system. And it's good for you physically because, you know, you're flushing out the system circulation-wise, but it's also really good for you mentally too, because if the only time I got on my bike was to go do really hard work and really hard intervals, I would crack, you know.
You'd hate your bike.
You'd hate the bike.
You'd learn
exactly.
To hate it.
And,
right.
And that's the last thing I want to do. And, you know, I do a lot of really hard work. And I admit there are days when I just look at the bike and go, I just can't do it today.
Yeah.
Or I get done with a workout. I'm just like, oh, seriously, I have to go do this again tomorrow. But usually, you know, if recovery is adequate and balanced, I always look forward to getting on my bike. And if it comes to a point where I'm not looking forward to getting on my bike, I know that I need to take a little bit more recovery. So going out and doing a recovery ride is really great, because then I'm not doing intervals, so I can slow down. I can stop and take pictures. I can really enjoy the scenery. I can go out with friends. I can stop at the coffee shop and have a pastry. So it's really important mentally as well as physically.
You can ride with us and see the mountain laurel.
Exactly.
Yes. Oh, indeed. So, okay, so what kinds of routes do you do when you're doing a recovery ride?
It depends. So recovery rides tend to be shorter. So I'm a little bit limited because then the radius, you know, starting from my house, I'm not going to go out quite as far as I would if I were doing a 5-hour, 4-hour ride. And I usually try to keep those routes pretty flat because it's, you know, going uphill. Trust me, I can go up a hill really, really easy. But there's a limit to it because eventually you go so slow you fall over.
Right.
So, I try to keep the routes flat because then I can go a little bit easier on a flat road than going up a hill. And the other thing about a flat road is that you also don't have the downhills for coasting. So you're spinning your legs and you're moving your legs and you're pedaling the whole time, which, like I said, kind of gets back to that active recovery aspect of it where you want to move your muscles and you want to move your blood, but you don't want to be taxing the system.
So, yeah, I found that I did a recovery ride one day and I went to Hampton and I said never again.
A few too many hills.
Exactly.
So all you do is go up and down.
Because because I was going up the hill and I was trying to go really, really slow. And as you said, there's a limit to how slow. Either you're going to go so slow you're going to tip over, or you just can't do it and you're not getting the good recovery. And Hampton, don't get me wrong, Hampton, shout out, holla. You're beautiful. Hampton is one of the most beautiful places to ride. I mean, there's some gorgeous, gorgeous towns out there that we love to ride. And Hampton, you are by far one of them. Beautiful, beautiful roads. Canterbury, you're another one. Scotland, you're another one. Ashford, Eastford, we love you. You have just such absolutely beautiful roads. And the only thing is, you know, on a recovery ride, Hampton is a difficult place to go because you've got that Maury Marcy Station thing going on. It's just too...
Or North Bear Hill Road. Or,
yeah.
You know, I mean, Hammond Hill Road. Have you discovered Hammond Hill Road yet?
Well, yeah.
Not yet.
No, oh, boy,
Hammond Hill is pretty harsh.
For you.
Mm. Yeah, that's a pretty harsh one. That's one of the... I heard some stat that's like one of the steepest...
It's a double-digit monster. It's not happy. It's there. You have to work really hard to get up it.
So one of the things that's important is, you know, I try to tell people that in addition to exercise, you know, to do intervals and to challenge yourself, it's important to get exercise where you are in a low cortisol state, where you're actually lowering your cortisol. And one of the things we often tell people to do is go for leisure walks in nature. Well, you can do a leisure bike in nature too.
Exactly.
And so if you can find flat roads that have pretty stuff around them, that's an exciting thing to do. This is where the rail trail comes in as well, because that's no more than what, 2% grade?
Right. And the Blue Herons.
And you can go see the Blue Herons.
The Blue Herons are awesome behind the bowling alley in North Windham.
Yeah.
Have you seen those yet?
No.
Oh.
See, there's so many more Where Does That Road Go mysteries to solve.
Oh, right. I got some good stuff.
We've been in this area a while. There's a lot of roads.
Yeah.
So let's talk about nutrition a little bit.
Yeah.
Again, we have a lot of people who are listening who are just getting started out with fitness, but we have some other people who are excited about their fitness and do ride bicycles. For someone who is active in cycling, what does nutrition look like? Just 101.
Nutrition looks pretty basic, actually. It's not, you know, this is a really important point, I think, is nutrition is not rocket science. Good nutrition, you know, you go back to basics. You want to minimize processed foods, eat whole foods. So I usually do a lot of cooking for myself. And of course, that takes a lot of time. So I usually devote 1 or 2 days a week to making huge batches of things. So I'll just spend, you know, my Mondays are usually my day off. So it also happens to be the day we pick up our CSA. So I'll usually take those veggies, do a lot of chopping, do a lot of roasting, and I'll just have, you know, huge bowls of pre-prepared vegetables in the fridge. And it's great because then you can throw them into an omelet. You can cook them up with chicken breast. You can throw them on top of a salad. But I try to make the time that I spend in the kitchen stretch so that I'm not just spending, you know, hours a day in the kitchen every day. And so this is something I think a lot of athletes do as well, is trying to cook ahead. So you cook enough that it's going to last you the next few days, because if I come home from a really hard 4-hour ride with tons of intervals, I'm spent. I'm totally wasted. The last thing I want to do is go stand on my feet in the kitchen, but I still need that really good, high quality nutrition. So it's nice to have that stuff sitting in the fridge. And we generally try to keep just, you know, healthy foods in the kitchen. So if we feel snacky or something, I go downstairs. The best, you know, the only options available to me are really nice, high density nutritional options. And they also happen to taste really good.
Fran has a great system for that. It's called me.
Teamwork also helps. That's a fact.
Yeah. we have a different situation, though. I mean, we have we're both running. So one of the things you'll see is, you know, Amber is a professional cyclist. Her job is to be a cyclist, and she's
right.
it's we're so in awe of you. but you know what? Most people listening, that's not who we're talking to right now. Who we're talking to right now are people who may be athletes and definitely have jobs. So we have to work in, and Ron and I run our own businesses. So we have to work in fitness and nutrition. And Ron and I have it easier than a lot of people listening because we don't have a child in the house. You have commute, but you have flexibility in terms of how you work.
Yeah.
And you have the ability to work from home a lot. And I have a terrible commute. 2 miles. Right. So I have a non-commute. Commuting is not an issue for me. And so we have a lot of time that we can fit in cooking, fitness, nutrition. I have an issue with cooking because on my work days, I'm at my office for, 10, 12 hours.
Right.
That's just kind of how it goes with the kind of job I have. But, our thing is we have easy things that are fresh, that are easy to put together.
I'm into the 15-minute meal.
Yeah.
That's my thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I think I learned that from being an athlete, is mm-hmm. that, you know, you just, like you say, you get back from a ride. You've been out for 4 hours. You're cooked. And you just, but you're also really hungry.
Right.
And you just want to eat. So you learn very quickly what you can throw together in 15 minutes or less. And you go with it.
Yeah,
and you can put basic nutrition together fairly quickly, and really get good food from it.
Yeah,
we eat a lot of salads.
We do, but salads, you know, I mean, and you know, people go, "Oh, salads! How can you?
Oh my goodness,
salads?
Our salads are awesome!
Oh, our salads are intense!
You should come to our house and have salad.
Yeah, you should come over, and I'll make you the ten.
Our salad is a religious experience.
Fran calls it the no brainer salad. Is what she
no brainer salad also. BAS, which is a shout out to Jill Coleman, who is a nutritionist. BAS, big A salad. Right. Yeah.
Right.
And so it has, you know, everything in the kitchen sink in it. And it's usually, you know, a lot of vegetables, a little bit of cheese if you're not sensitive to it. And the cheese can change up. You know, sometimes it's blue cheese, sometimes it's feta, sometimes it's goat, sometimes it's cheddar, the cheese changes up.
Right.
The nuts, we're pretty partial to walnuts and almonds.
Well,
but that can change
sometimes. Well,
there's
a lot of goodness with walnuts and almonds.
Yeah.
But you can throw pecans in there.
You
can
do
throw,
pecans,
you
can do sunflower, pumpkin
really.
Seeds. So that's the big thing. And we almost never do prepared salad dressing. I have a thing for fire cider, and Ron won't do the fire cider. He likes his balsamic vinegar. And then we use olive oil. And then we use really good quality salt. So we use the, you know, pink, some version of pink, which is going to be Himalayan or Utah pink salt, peppercorns,
mm-hmm.
and a mixed herb seasoning that goes on it. We have a go-to. I'm not going to say the brand name, but we have a go-to that we use. And we're out of it, so I have to go get some more.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
and we throw in like cranberries, and we throw in sometimes I cut up apples. And
he'll cut up
different dried fruits. Papaya, I've been doing,
or different
lately.
Fresh fruits.
Really good, yummy.
Right? And this is the thing with salad, is that I think, you know, people who don't eat a lot of salad kind of think of salad as like, oh, this is, it's rabbit food. You know,
it's,
and you're just munching on lettuce.
Tomato.
Well, and bad lettuce and tomato.
Really, I mean, the sky is the limit. And somebody said this to me once, and I think it's a great way of thinking of salad. It's like nachos, but on greens.
Yeah.
Hey, there you go.
So yeah,
you
could do it
that way.
You know,
the sky's the limit with nachos, right? Sky's the limit with salad. You can make it whatever you want. But the nice thing is when you just put it on a bed of greens, it just ups the nutrition factor. And I love your idea of the homemade salad dressings. A friend of mine showed me this great technique that I've adopted, which is Whenever we have leftover glass jars, we just wash them and save them. And then I'll, you know, if we're making a salad, I'll throw in, you know, a little olive oil. And usually, you know, a little bit of olive oil, something acidic, you know, whether that's lemon juice or vinegar, some salt, maybe something a little bit sweet. Like, I really like a combination of lemon juice and a little bit of maple syrup.
Yes.
And you just shake up the jar. And then, you know, whatever you don't use, you can use on your next salad. And then you might have like 3 or 4 jars in the fridge at a time. Mm-hmm. So whatever flavor profile you're in the mood for, you can really have a lot of variety when it comes to salad.
Sure.
And I think that's a good thing to keep it from getting too boring.
Yeah.
And it's good fuel for what you're doing.
Exactly.
Also.
It's really nutrient dense. And this is something, again, our bodies are constantly taking in information from our environment. And so a good thing to keep in mind is that when you eat, food is fuel, number one, but it's also information. So whether or not you enjoy the food is going to have an effect on how your body responds to it. So if it's something that you really enjoy, your body's going to be thinking like, oh, we're happy right now. Things must be pretty good out there. So there's no sense in, you know, panicking or going into fight or flight mode, which will keep, you know, again, that has an effect on the cortisol. And the other thing about food that gives your brain information is the nutrient density of the food. So, you know, you need to get in enough calories to replace what you're burning to fuel your exercise, to fuel your bike rides. But you also have to consider the nutrient density of those calories that you're taking in. So if you're taking in a lot of calories in the form of highly processed foods, whether it happens to be, you know, a cheeseburger from the local fast food joint, not that I have anything against cheeseburgers. Let me be clear on that. Some cheeseburgers can be highly nutrient dense. We'll just be honest. But some aren't. So if you're just taking a bunch of what we call empty calories, your body's going to get the message that, okay, there's stuff out there, but there's not a lot of nutrition out there. And so it might start thinking, okay, things might not be going that well out there because there's not a lot of nutrition out there because there's not a lot of nutrition coming in. And if there's not nutrition available, then your brain starts thinking famine. And it starts in, you know, it could potentially start increasing stress levels in your body, especially if there are toxins associated with the processed foods that you're taking in. So just keep in mind that what you put into your body is giving your body information about what's going on outside of it. And you want your body to understand that you're safe, there's abundant food and nutrition, and those messages are going to help keep your stress levels low. And it's also going to help your body process food in a way that's not going to be, you know, storing fat, for example. So if your body thinks that there's a famine going on out there, it's going to go into storage mode. And that's the last thing that most of us want. So just remember that, you know, eating is, it's about enjoying your food. It's about fueling the joyful, wonderful, fun activities that we do in our lives. But it's also sending a message to your body about your environment and whether or not you're safe. And most of us are pretty safe in this modern day and age, thankfully. I mean, that's not something we want to take for granted. But yeah, food is also information and sending signals to your body.
Well, Amber, it was so wonderful to have you on Radio Naturopath today. What you've got great information and a lot of great tips, proprioception, nutrition, what cycling can do for your body. So I want to thank you so much for being on Radio Naturopath today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Radio Naturopath. I have Amber Pierce here today, who is now racing for the
Vitalogic Pro Women's Team,
which is based in
Austria, but I also race stateside for Team Good Life. It's a lot of fun.
That's so great. And you're also a member of Bike Mansfield.
Yes.
And so you can be seen around town at times.
Absolutely. Please, I'm usually the one on my bike waving, so please wave back.
That's right. You always wave. You are so good about waving. So I noticed that on the weekend, and I emulate it. I mean, I like to do that too, but I'm so impressed by, because we want people to know that cyclists are people, and we want to make a connection with people, other cyclists, other walkers, and people in cars. We want to let them know that, hey, we're connections. Hey, we're out here. Hey, it's a beautiful day. Hey, let's all be together and enjoy this.
Yeah, we're a community.
We are a community. Thank you so much for coming on Radio Naturopath.
Thank you.
Amber. You're listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. This has been Radio Naturopath. And we will be back next week for more Radio Naturopath.